This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of all people are needed to make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio on bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can log into our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com, to join us live, listen to archives of previous shows, or you can join us live in our chat room on Paltalk. You can also listen by phone, dial 760-569-7676, entering access code 192919 pound when prompted, or on your computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2 and click the listen icon. The People Speak invites audience participation. If you have questions and comments for our guest or topic during the show, please call toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, my guest is Rodimus Pura. Some may remember him as the young Kane, better known as Grasshopper, in the old television western series Kung Fu. Others may remember him best as John Edwards and his relationship with Mary Ingalls on The Little House on the Prairie. Hi, Rodimus.
Hello.
Now, I'd like to start tonight by asking you to fill in some of what you've been doing since we last saw you on television. My understanding is you stopped doing performance in the 1980s sometime.
That is right. Yeah, about the mid-80s, I realized that for my own well-being, I had to literally get out of town. And so I first had to wean myself off of my expectations that I had for what I hoped was an adult career as a director, and move on to other things in my life, yes.
And so what kind of things have you moved into?
Well, I decided to go back to my first love, which was making films and video. But, you know, to break into that, it's a long road. So I started at the bottom, and I ended up learning a bunch of skills, in technical skills with wiring and equipment and such. And that led to me forging out on my own and starting an audio video design, home theater design business back in the late 80s, about 88. And that's what I've been doing for 25 years.
So then changing direction at a point in life that you hadn't anticipated, you've managed to apparently go on successfully. I understand you're married and you're still married to the same woman you married back in the 1980s.
That's right, 1984, leap year day, 6,000 feet above the Mojave Desert. We called the event a leap of faith. We were married in the plane and then jumped out on our first skydive.
No. Now, I've seen some unusual weddings, but I don't think I'd have been a guest.
Neither was my mom.
Now, Rodimus, the reason I brought that up is because you, of course, were famous when you were playing young Kane. You were what? 8, 9, 10 years old?
11 when the pilot was filmed, and then 12, 13, 14 during the series, yeah.
Yeah, see, I remember that. I'm a bit older than you, and I remember you as Grasshopper.
Right.
Now, we've seen over the years so many bad outcomes for people who are involved in show business really young. We know it's a very hard business. And in fact, when I was looking through your resume, I noticed that you had done some episodes of Family Affair and you and Nisa Jones, which is one of the child stars that impacted me when her outcome impacted me deeply with concern for what this business does to young people. So when I read your background and the updates, I was impressed that you had a positive outcome. But has it always been so positive?
Elaborate. Yes. Well, first of all, yes, there is a common experience that I've come to understand in my adult years, a common experience that I share with many other former child actors who, when Hollywood is done with them, and of course, that's the way Hollywood works, there is such a thing as typecasting. It's a horrible thing in most cases. And what the weird thing about being a child, being typecast as a child, is you don't stay a child forever. So when you, when you're no longer a kid and you've got incredible chops, you know, and stuff, they don't want you anymore. And it's a very disillusioning, confusing thing at first, and which is one of the reasons why you get young people kind of busting out all over, if you will, meaning that, when you no longer have the acclaim, the attention, the adrenaline, and the job, the money, well, you kind of wonder what the heck's going on, and you get really upset, and no one is there, typically, at least in those, that era, no one was available to counsel you and say, well, you know, that's just the way it is, and you gotta start thinking about another career, la, la, la. And instead, you know, you're just kind of left out in the cold, and no one has the decency to just kind of take you aside and inform you about what's actually going on. You just think you did something, or I thought I did something wrong, and I was failing, and it was very, you know, very difficult thing to go through. But, you know, whenever anybody feels low self-esteem, they're going to act out some way or another if they have predilections for such a thing, and I certainly am no exception to that, and I also know many other people who went through a very similar process as I did.
Okay, now, something I'm curious about. I've had training in theater, and I've performed on stage, and I know the kind of involvement a person gets in taking on a role. And the Kung Fu series was very unusual in introducing the Eastern philosophies, and I'm just really curious about this. In your preparation for that role and being exposed to these philosophies that weren't real common in the USA at the time, do you ever feel that that has impacted how you view the world or how you have coped with the circumstances of your life as things change?
It's a wonderful question. I really appreciate your asking. Well, as it happens, I was introduced to Eastern thought well before my role, my performance in the show. My mom was introduced to something called theosophy back when I was a toddler, and she brought me to Sunday school version of Theosophy at the United Lodge of Theosophists in L.A. And from, you know, 5, 6 years old, I heard the terms reincarnation and karma and, you know, universal consciousness and things like that. And even though at that time as a child, you know, those things are very highfalutin intellectual concepts to a young person, you're just enjoying just being a kid. And then, you know, I started to think about these other ideas. So I had a kind of an intellectual grasp of it, which was enough, I suppose, for me to swing the opinion of the people hiring me for the show my way, which I feel very fortunate to have been involved with, obviously. But your question, more to your question, yes, certainly the show encapsulated in every episode some kernel of Lao Tzu or Confucianism or Buddhism, and I definitely resonated with those ideas. They were not foreign to me. And as and the rest of your question has to do with, you know, how did that carry through in life? Well, I kept studying those ideas and that thought, and eventually arrived at my own version of it, which I think we all need to do when you have your brain full of somebody else's thinking. It's important to make that your own in order to integrate it and actually have a living version of a philosophy to go through one's life with. So, yes, it did. You know, I've still gone through all kinds of trials and tribulations just like any fellow human being would, but I guess my filter or my point of view on it is more, you know, Eastern than Western, I guess.
Now, at what phase in your life during the various aspects of your career and stuff do you like to look back at the most?
Well, I'm reminded most often about Kung Fu, obviously. I mean, you know, I'll be watching Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, and he'll say to a guest, ah, you have much to learn, Grasshopper, you know, and that feels good. And my wife and I always look at each other and kind of laugh, like, hey, there's another cultural reference. The new film coming out, Reds 2, there's apparently some little spoof on Grasshopper master-student relationship there, and they actually use the term Grasshopper. So the fun thing about that is that, you know, my character that I played, has become a free-floating cultural icon out in the universe here, at least locally, and I get to be anonymous at the same time. I can be out in public and no one recognizes me, and that's kind of great, because that's one of the horrible things about fame is you have to give up your privacy, or at least your sense of privacy out in public, and I don't have that. But I get to enjoy the grasshopper thing. So I'm most often reminded about grasshopper, and that's the role that certainly has the most meaning to me on a personal level from, you know, my career of having played that. I mean, it's been a really amazing experience to be grasshopper. But you know what? Let me just add one more thing. You know, I don't go around telling people about it. I prefer getting to know people as a fellow human, as I said earlier. And then if it comes up in conversation somehow or another, it's always a pivotal moment for me, because they're either going to react one way or another to the information, sometimes they stop relating to me as a person and they start relating to the character or the fame or whatever, and it becomes a different conversation at that point. But generally, I'm very proud of the work I did. I'm very proud to have been involved in an incredibly seminal, unusual piece of work. I mean, where else have we seen on television a character put into practice, you know, Eastern thought? It just hasn't happened, to my knowledge, since then, you know. And it was done so well. There was very good story editors on the show. They made sure to really adhere to the principles of the philosophy and not go too far afield with it. And that lent it some integrity, and that's one of the reasons why people trusted it and, you know, devoted themselves to watching it. I had people tell me all the time, oh, we used to get together, the whole dorm used to get together, or my whole family used to watch it together. It was a religious experience, you know. I was like, wow, okay, well, that's amazing, and I'm so happy that had that kind of effect on the culture.
Well, for me, it was significant because even as a child, I was a bit older than you, but I do remember it as an introduction to a way of thinking that wasn't something that we heard all the time, and it opened up my curiosity to the idea that there's many beliefs out there and a judgment of right or wrong is predetermining some things that shouldn't be predetermined. So it helped to open the minds of a lot of people in that generation. But now, what...
May I just interject something here? Do you mind? I think the culture's mind was kind of opened up by the recently happening 60s. You know, and there were a lot of people who were searching for something to, you know, to really sink their teeth into philosophically, because, you know, just say the counterculture or psychedelic culture or whatever, that did open up people's minds, but eventually people had to gravitate to something that was a little bit more tried and true than the newest, you know, mind-opening substance or what have you. And I think that, that's why Kung Fu, the timing of it was so good, in that it did give, you know, at least a popular television audience, something really kind of meaty to watch and enjoy. So I'm concurring with what you're saying. I just wanted to add that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, now, in this time, like you said, that was made in the context of the 60s and 70s, the civil rights and a lot of things that were in turmoil and changing rapidly, and young people were changing rapidly. And here we leap another 40 years ahead, and we're in a time when things are equally tumultuous in the world and unpredictable for our young people, and we see a lot happening with young people in the world striking out or just an immense number of things I can't even touch on. And kids today are facing that same disconnect where all of a sudden they realize that when you found that you were no longer needed in Hollywood, that you needed to look somewhere else.
Right.
What would you say to these young people today based in that context?
Well, you know, the more I look at cultures and, you know, just human existence on the planet, it seems like tumult and change has really been a constant. And you can look at specific cultural things that kind of come in cycles and waves and such. But it's kind of been the human condition in a way, or at least a societal condition, where, you know, something becomes a little staid and needs to be revamped and changed. And the people who are in an older set of, they've adapted to the way of life as it is. And the younger people come in and go, you know, they're there to question. They're there to say, hey, you know, this isn't, what's so great about this? Can't we make this better? You know? So what I would say is, I think that every younger generation needs to be listened to because they have the objectivity, because of their new, fresh perspective on things, to point out where our failings are in the things that have become ossified too set in stone. And so things radically have to change now and then. I mean, even Thomas Jefferson said, listen, we have to have a revolution. What was it? Did he say every 20 years or 50 years for this country to stay healthy, we have to have a revolution? Well, that's what happened in the 60s, culturally at least. And I think what's happening now is, I think because of the availability of a lot of information through the phone, through our phones, there's no excuses not to know what's going on, because if you've got a smartphone, it's all there. And, of course, the computer and everything else. But because of that, because of information being able to be exchanged all around the world so quickly that now is another moment when this kind of questioning has to happen, because people know what's really happening. They know the corporations are acting, are being protected as individuals, and they have the same rights as individuals when they should not. Corporations are run by what I consider to be sort of mechanical thinking now. The computers spit out data, and the humans respond to the data, and it's like a machine. It's not a human. It's not an individual. It's a machine mind, if you will, in many corporate cultures. And of course, humans execute those edicts of the computer. But young people are saying, you know what? This stinks. We don't want to do this anymore. There's a better way, and that's why you have the Freegan movement that's out there, which is just one little faction, and of course, the Occupy movement, which I think is great, and it's unfortunate that it seems to have kind of petered out a little bit, but I know that those people who were involved in that are going to continue to stay in touch. They're going to continue to figure out how to work change without having Big Brother come down on them too hard, and that's the trick here. We have this interesting convolution, conflict right now between, NSA data gathering on individuals and individuals trying to connect with each other to be able to affect positive change. And the two kind of are obviously a little bit in clash. And so it's a very interesting time. That's the Chinese had it was both a curse and a sideways curse. May you live in interesting times. Well, we sure do. And I support change. I think change is part of life. It's inevitable, and anything that resists change is doomed to fail. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and it leads into something else I was going to. And in the same way that civil rights and the Vietnam War and the riots of the late 60s, the assassinations, 4 assassinations in a decade, shaped the thinking of the young people of my generation, the young people that were young like we were on 9/11 are now coming of age and entering, or are adults. In fact, Edward Snowden, I'm trying to think, would have been, 17 at the time of 9/11?
Right, wow. Uh-huh.
And as you said, now they're growing up in an age where the awareness of it's so easy to collect at it, and it's easier for people like the NSA to justify it because they're not looking at people. It's not like they're going and sitting outside your house and peering through binoculars like they did on the TV shows when we were kids. Do you think that the young people are going to impact and demand a stop to this as the young people stood up in the 60s and early 70s?
Well, I have a suspicion that, the government, the U.S. government, is probably very concerned about all about the Arab Spring, because over and over and continuing to appear in the media, even with our short attention span of news cycle, these things keep coming up every 6 months or a year. Another nation is breaking out and, hey, we want young people saying we want to do things another way. And, it's not just young people. I think that that's a misnomer too, possibly. Young people have the energy to go out there and make signs and paint signs and do political theater. But there's an awful lot of people across all walks of life that join in, just as they did in the 60s in the United States, just as they are doing right now in Egypt. You know, it's not just young people. Young people are the ones who have this sort of invincible sense of themselves that are willing to take more risks, which have to be done. That's the front line. Risks have to be taken on the front line, and an occasional window needs to be broken. I mean, you know, I'm not going to be the one to throw that rock now, but I understand why there is a need to do that. And because if you don't throw the rock, if the window doesn't get broken, then there's less people are going to pay attention to what's actually going on in that particular area, meaning geographically or politically. So, I mean, it takes all of us to change the culture. Young people alone aren't going to be able to change it, but with our support of people who understand the importance of change, change will or can and will occur. It's inevitable.
So, the one I think too, and I want to ask your opinion of this, because something I observed, I've been back to school several times, and that when I was doing my theater training, most of the students were half my age, and they were always referring back to the 60s and 70s like they missed it. Mm-hmm. And something that struck me was that they weren't less motivated than our generation was, but they seemed to be struggling for a leader or a cause or a focus. And then on the balance, as an older person, I see that our government is throwing our young people literally to their deaths in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that a leader would have to be balanced in the idea of putting young people at risk when so many are being so callously thrown away.
So I'm not understanding your point or your question. I mean, can you...
In your observation, at what point are the adults, how do we balance the recognition and the need to lead them and trying to also protect them? As a parent, maybe that's what's motivating my question.
Okay. Interesting. Well, you know, even though I've been married for 30 years and I'm 52 years old, I did not have children. We tried to have kids and we couldn't, so we decided to not go that route. But because of that, we've actually been able to mentor several young people in our lives. And so I have a little bit, you know, I have some objectivity on parenting because I wasn't one, and I also have some insight because I've actually had the opportunity and the honor to give ideas to a few young people in my life. You know, what's interesting, I think, what's happening now is, at least I hope so. I mean, you know, my perspective, of course, is colored by my generation, my age, et cetera, but it seems to me that there's less of a bias against older folks, if you will, in this current younger generation upsetness, if you will. Whereas in the 60s, you know, there was the phrase, oh, never trust anybody over 30. Well, yeah, I think because young people realize and have that sort of nostalgia, like, as you said, for the 60s, oh, we missed that. Well, because of that nostalgia, that gives us as older people a little bit of an opportunity to, like you said, offer some guidance and you know, express our opinions, and they won't be dismissed as being farty, if you'll pardon the expression. And so there is a unique paradigm shaping up right now, I think, in regards to what is possible in youth culture and the culture at large, because it's not just all about young people, it's about us all cooperating, which we have to do. Again, sorry for the phone ring. We all have to do in order to make all of this happen. And again, the internet and the exchange of information, the open flow of information, irregardless of NSA data mining, we will be able to communicate, hopefully, and create a coalition, a coalescence of ideas to be able to have a kind of a velvet revolution, you know, because obviously no one wants to do this with violence, you know, overt violence, you know, hurting people, you know, there's property, corporate property that can be hurt, and I'm not encouraging that, I'm just saying, you know, that's not as harmful as people being hurt. And we can do this, I think, I had an idea years ago of a revolution taking place very silently, where all the people talk to each other behind, you know, behind the scenes and secretly, and then they all agree that at 12 o'clock on July 5th, we're going to just turn the dial the other way. Instead of pulling the levers the that we've been pulling to keep the culture going the way it is, we'll just push them the other way. And of course, it's a fantasy, but it can happen as quickly as that, just like we've witnessed, you know, in Egypt and other places near there. So, you know, really, it's so much up to our commitment to make change, because, you know, you can affect cultural change, but really, revolution, I think, truly is a personal experience. You must change yourself. I have to think differently and behave differently in order to change the world. And when I do that as an individual, and another person does that as an individual, and another person, then actual change takes place, rather than kind of this sort of passing show of outward society and stuff. Because really, change is an individual thing. If we change ourselves, society will naturally change to follow suit.
Well, I've heard the comment made frequently, and I've probably said it myself more than once, that one of the issues is that we're too comfortable. Not just our generation, but the young people. They're wrapped up in their video games and their iPods and iPhones and iPads and
I beg to differ with you on that. I think they're excuse me for interrupting you, pardon me.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, I see what you're saying, that, you know, there's the iPod thing, the isolationism that's happening with people just focusing on their technology and not in each other's eyes. Okay, that's true. But I think partially why so many young people are kind of retreating, if you will, into their technology is because they know that something is afoot outside that is not right. And they know that they may have to live with their parents after they leave college instead of living on their own. The economics have changed. And yes, even though we all have phones and such, and we can talk to each other and text each other, there is this worry on the part of the younger generation, like, am I going to be able to be gainfully employed? You know, where am I going to get a job? How am I going to be able to afford the things that my parents could afford? And it's not happening, you know. So that kind of insecurity or fear of that potential, that reality, is a motivating factor, you know. And I think when enough people realize that, I'm sort of jumping around here, but, you know, in England, you know, what caused the punk movement to happen was because these kids grew up and they went, hey, you know what? We have no future. And so punk became a major way to express that disgust with what was supposed to be a society that was supposed to welcome them in as, you know, professionals and workers and, you know, people enjoying and sharing in the culture and society. But that's being threatened now. By the economics of things and by corporate greed and, frankly, individual greed, you know. And so when people have enough of that, they'll do something. So I trust that process completely, you know.
Okay, now that takes me back to the last election, because one of the things that had the Republican Party very concerned was they're losing the youth vote. And as these younger people who've grown up with the technology and with so many things that the other generation is like hostile to as the norm, that this is eroding it. And on the balance, then I have older people telling me, well, there's no point in voting because your vote don't count. You know, look at the election in 2000 with Bush or 2004 and so many others that they say are suspect. That what would you say to young people, especially since we are actually seeing an impact from their vote? At least one party is seen in the impact and seems a little panicked over it.
Mm-hmm. So your question is, exactly, can you rephrase it? I'm so sorry.
When young people ask you, why should we vote?
Okay. All right. Well, okay. We have the right to vote in this country, and we have the right to express what we want to have happen. Now, we're limited. All of our desire and all of our want and need to change is unfortunately funneled into a two-party system, which I think is part of the problem as well. and then people complain when a third person, you know, comes up, like Ralph Nader, you know, in those elections, those earlier elections you were talking about, people were so upset with Ralph Nader, you know, hey, you know, if you hadn't run, Gore would have been elected for sure. And it's like, well, okay. Perhaps, but I voted for Nader. I also did a vote exchange. I had someone who was going to vote for Nader vote for Gore, there was that whole vote exchange going on, so we actually tried not to hurt Mr. Gore's chances. But I also think that that whole thing was blown over by the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court made a couple of very serious mistakes, especially in that particular instance. So what would I say to young people? I would tell them that your vote counts. Do not become apathetic, because apathy is exactly what the greed mind wants you to do. They want you to become apathetic, so you'll just buy the product, sink back into, you know, your own smaller existence. Don't connect with other people on a cultural level. Don't talk about things, you know, that are important, because, you know, no one's really going to bother to listen to you. That is unfortunate. That's a slow death. And I think that voting is at least one expression of our participation in what, for the most part, is a democracy. Honestly, I think that there's, you know, it's a false democracy we have in this country. And but I also, you know, I voted for Obama, and you know, I have a funny feeling that, you know, on the first day of any person's presidency, when they walk into the White House, someone takes them into a special room and says, okay, here's the manual. Here's what you're going to be able to do. Here's what you're not going to be able to do. And that's kind of what they get on day one. And can you imagine to come into such a powerful job and be informed that half of what you wanted to do is just not going to happen? And to try to do that anyway, which I think was attempted on Obama's part, you know, that's to do that, to try to attempt that is a valiant thing to do. Now, that's why we have such an intractable Republican Party right now. That's why they're just all falling in lockstep, just denying anything that, you know, Obama wants to make happen. That's the problem, you know. But there's one other ingredient here. You know, people have criticized Obama for being he's just an organizer. You know what? He has been trying to inform the public over the last 6-7 years about how we can organize in a peaceful way to make these changes happen. Unfortunately, people vote for somebody, and then they expect that person to do all the work. That's not how it works. Yes, there are leaders. There are people who can inspire, you know, who can encourage, which I think Obama is trying to do as much as possible. But there are these other realities that if you don't get off your butt and do something, nothing's going to happen. And one leader and one regime really can't do that alone. They need the will of the people behind them. And that's, I think, kind of what we're vacillating around right now, is how do we do this? How do we make the kind of changes that we want to have happen? Well, we do it by embarrassing the Republican Party, which is what they're getting a drubbing right now, and they deserve every bit of it. You know, so that's all I have to say about that. Keep on voting, young people. Okay.
Okay, now, we're going to shift gears here a bit. We're about at the halfway mark in the show. I do want to note that this is Jeanette Lefebvre of the People Speak Radio on bbsradio.com. Now, during the second half of the show, I've started receiving questions from various listeners. So if we can shift gears, we're going to let the listeners ask you what they find of interest. And I've got the first one here.
Wonderful.
Is from Sherry in Indiana. I love the Kung Fu TV series. What was it like working with David Carradine? Was he like the character Kane?
Mm-hmm. That's a question I get very often, and it's a, you know, it's a totally appropriate question. David was not Kwai Chang Kane. David had a very ambivalent relationship with Hollywood. He was the son of a famous character actor, John Carradine. His name, David's original first name, was John, so he was actually John Jr., but he rejected that, took the name David to distinguish himself from his father and to try to have a separate career. As much as David liked fame, he also felt like, you know, he was too cool for it. And, you know, he did some very, how do I put this? You know, he, I don't think that he really took the responsibility of the job on. I don't think he took it on. I think that when you're given such an amazing opportunity to represent such a unique individual in pop culture, in creative work, that you kind of have some obligation not to be that person, but to at least respect what other people see in that character, and to try to make the distinction. I mean, when people relate to me, all they go, "Oh, you're a grasshopper. That's so great," you know. The first thing I try to do is to honor their appreciation of the show. If it resonated with them, that means that you know those ideas are in their heart and in their minds. And so, I would say people have issues. You know, everybody has issues, and David had issues that I think kept him from being able to be more gracious about the incredible opportunity that was handed to him. So, I can elaborate on that if there's any more questions about David. I can go into it. I personally like the guy. I was very young at the time I met him. My mom, actually, a little known story here is that my mom actually was flown out to California from the New York stage where she was performing, and David Carradine was performing at the same time, and Universal Studios flew them out in 1963 to do screen tests for what was then the last days of the contract system, the studio system that the studios had, where they would hire people to be in their stable. And my mom and David Carradine were both brought out for that. So that's kind of an interesting coincidence that a few years later I would be playing a younger version of David. So I was intrigued by David. He was, he was a trickster. I guess, Castaneda would probably call him a trickster. And he was pushing at the boundaries of propriety, of self-respect, of respect for other people, respect for the job, respect for the studio, respect for the public who really was looking up for some guidance from this individual, both the character and the person who played him. And I think he fell short on the latter part of that.
Okay, well, I have two questions here, but the second one coming in is more connected to what we were just speaking about. So an apology to the audience. I'm going to take Larry and Florida's question first. Was the manner of David Carradine's death as reported by the news, or was there something more sinister or murder that his family maintains as the cause? That's connected to the image that you were talking about, so I wanted to address that first.
Okay, sure, I understand. That makes sense. That's a good segue. So the family, the Carradine family, would like to believe, and would like the rest of us to believe, that there was foul play involved, because that would make the legacy, David's legacy, a little bit more wholesome, maybe, if someone else did him in. But I have to tell you that my wife and I were not surprised when we heard the information. We were saddened. We were shocked. It was horrible. But, we weren't surprised because I, for many years, have been kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop with David. David had some practices that he did, which had to do with actually dealing with his own control issues. He had some control issues, as some of us do. And one way that he would escape his frustration with wanting to be in control was to literally incapacitate himself. So he learned how to tie himself up. And he did so numerous occasions. I never witnessed one, but I know this from people who are close to him. And it makes sense. Who he was, who I knew him to be, it makes sense that he'd want to tie himself up and just completely become immobilized so that he could experience the release of being just, not in control. So I believe that though there is some evidence to suggest that there was somebody else in the hotel suite at or near the time of his death, and I could only tell you that that might have been a sexual partner who then freaked out when David slipped over the edge of life in the auto asphyxiation modality, and then just fled the scene. I don't think anybody did that to him. I think he did it to himself.
Okay, well, thank you, because that would be a tough question. Now, we'll go back to Lewis in Ohio. Rodimus, did you ever learn martial arts, and what was it like growing up at Famous at an early age? Did you have a normal school experience?
Another fine question, and thank you for asking. I did learn some martial arts. I was trained in the use of the staff, the stick, the bamboo staff. I did enjoy learning that, and I did take some Kung Fu and Tai Chi classes for a few years afterwards, during and afterwards. But I didn't keep it up, much to my loss. The physical discipline I did not have to keep up the martial arts. However, I had a lot on my plate, and that's the second part of your question. You know, being a child actor, as I mentioned earlier, is not an easy experience. It's not something I would wish on any young person, honestly. When people come up to me, parents say, oh, my kid is so talented, I want to put him in the movies. I say, if he or she wants to really act, why don't you get them involved in some community theater until they're an adult? Because exposing a child to the seediness of Hollywood is not a healthy thing for any young mind. And I had to balance being on the set amongst Teamsters and people with not much sensitivity to the fact that there was a young person around them. I had to balance, I would experience that one or two days a week, and then I'd go back to public school. And I'd go back to public school, and I'd be challenged to fights. Wannabe gang members would, want to prove their macho-ness to their buddies by, saying, I'm going to kick your ass after school, grasshopper, meet me out front. And I would have to, ask my teachers to please let me go 10 minutes early so I could hightail it up to the bus, to the bus stop and take my bus home to avoid, getting pummeled. And I did get beat up once or twice. And I had kids teasing me, this was 1972, 73. And if you can imagine, all the cool kids, all the cool guys, they had hair down to their shoulders. They were BMXers. They were skateboarders. And the only people at that point in time, this is before punk and before skinheads, the only people who had bald heads in school were either cancer victims or had a case of the lice. So to be bald in school, and also to be on a TV show at the same time, because people know I didn't have cancer or anything like that, but it was like, I was a freak. I really was a freak, and it was really tough to be a freak in school and yet be totally, being praised by adults for my work the other part of the week. So it was quite a dichotomy, and it was difficult to manage. So I don't think I really would have even had maybe if I kept up the kung fu, maybe that would have been better. I could have kicked their butts, and I would have developed some self discipline, which would allow me to see through some of the confusion that I had as a young person.
Okay, well, that goes right into the question from the next guest, Rihanna in Missouri. Rodimus, did you have major problems as a child actor, and how did you overcome these experiences?
Okay, well, I was very professional. One of the reasons why I worked so much as a kid is that I delivered the goods, the emotional stuff. My first role was as a dying boy, Anthony Quinn's dying son in a film called A Dream of Kings, which came out in 1969. And, again, with the typecasting, my first role, dying kid, well, I ended up playing a lot of kids in trouble. And then of course Grasshopper, who was a very unusual character. He's half breed, half American, half Chinese, orphan, so that's in keeping with the types of roles I was getting. And I'm really proud of the fact that I was a child character actor. I wasn't just like, Tommy from next door. I was actually, an interesting, suffering person with some emotions and stuff. So it was very satisfying, to act those roles. Nonetheless, because of the other things that I mentioned, that were going on in my life, it did cause me to feel very outcast, I did not have a very happy school life. My mother did not understand how to, relate to what was happening to me. She didn't really know because she was a fairly self-involved person at that time. And, so I didn't get the guidance that I needed. And so I floundered and I flailed and I got bad grades and I hated school. And I actually got out of school. I took the GED in 11th grade and I, much to my mom's concern, but I wanted to get out of high school so I could go to college. So actually as a 12th grader, when I would have been a 12th grader, I was actually taking second year film courses at LACC, Los Angeles City College, which had a really great film department. And so I was pursuing what I wanted to study, not what they wanted me to learn. Although, I'm a self-taught person. I've studied a lot of things. I've always been interested in science and astronomy and biology and psychology and philosophy. So I read a lot. I read a lot of things, and I got a lot more out of that than most of my schooling. I did have an amazing 5th and 6th grade teacher at Gardner Street Elementary School. Her name is Lizette Gunther. She was Lizette Altman at that time, and she is by far the most influential teacher I ever had in my life, and she is still teaching to this day at Gardner Street Elementary School in Hollywood.
So, yeah, you'd already talked about the kind of abattoir that Hollywood could be. Now, from Violet in Florida, I have seen the documentary on Frances Farmer. Is that really the way it is? Hollywood dictates your life, lies are told about you by press agents, and in fact could destroy your life like they did Frances Farmer.
Well, that's going way back. It's a great question. I don't know if a lot of people will know the reference to Frances Farmer, Fanny Farmer, as she was called. I think Jessica Lange did an incredible, I think it was Jessica Lange who portrayed her in a film about Fanny Farmer. And that's an extreme example that we can actually see correlations to this day. I mean, let's say Justin Bieber, for example, not to pick somebody out, just to pick somebody out at random, okay? I don't know him. I don't know him well, but I can see the pattern, as I've seen in other peers of mine and in, you know, people who have rose to success rather suddenly. Yes, you think you're in control. They meaning the people who are running the show behind the scenes, because there's, you know, a lot of money involved here. And whenever there's a lot of money, there's a lot of people who are stepping in to manage that money. And then, and since you're the producer of that money, technically, they're going to be managing you too. But they don't want a person to think they're being managed, so they kind of give them some free rein, enough to, you know, make some mistakes and such. And then nowadays we have a cycle where a famous person can go through that and then go through rehab and come out the other end, and be, you know, have a whole second act, you know, or third act. So that's kind of interesting that that's developed now. I don't think that existed back in my era. You know, you flunked out and, you either picked yourself up and figured out what to do with the rest of your life, or you indulged your weaknesses and got lost. And a lot of, there are many, you know, there's several former child actors who are no longer with us because, it was just too tough and they didn't have enough of a support system or a strong enough, you know, the intestinal fortitude to accept the reality of what was actually going on around them, both when they were in the process of being famous and then afterwards. Justin Bieber, as I mentioned, I don't want to sort of drop that ball like that. I would say that, you know, he's acting out in ways right now, and that's par for the course. It's not unusual. People's fascination with that, I think, is macabre. I think the whole culture of personality, frankly, is a little bit twisted and unhealthy for the culture at large, and also the individuals who are at the forefront, you know, being those famous people. It's just a weird thing. Fame is a very strange thing. I don't understand why people have this idea that people who are somehow in the limelight are superior to them or something. They're living some kind of dream that us as non-famous people will never get to experience. And it's a kind of a longing and a fantasy that really isn't true. I mean, I've worked for many top stars in my business. In the 25 years that I've been doing home theaters, I've worked for Johnny Depp 3 times. I've worked for Nicolas Cage 2 times. I've worked for Robert Downey Jr., Sharon Stone, and more people. And, you know, they all deal with it differently. And I think that one of the healthiest people that I encountered was Johnny Depp, because at the height of his fame, he kept people who knew him before he was famous close. He had his mom and his stepdad always near him. He had a best friend of his from junior high who he kept close to him so that he could keep some perspective on it. As soon as you start believing what people say about you, then you're really in jeopardy of going the wrong direction. But if you stay grounded, then you can wade your way through it, all this stuff, and get out the other end and still have a productive life and be a healthy person.
Okay, Rodimus, we're down to just 5 minutes, and we've already mentioned David Carradine. I asked you earlier about the impact of the early learning exposure to the Eastern ideas impact on your life, but over your career, you've worked with many, many well-known famous people, Anthony Quinn, Brian Keith, Michael Landon, and you've mentioned a few others. Before we close, out of all these people that you've worked with, who stands out in your mind as someone who particularly touched you at a moment when you felt that you needed that, it made a difference?
You mean any person? Well, actually, you know, my probably my only champion a person who sort of stood by me during very difficult years when I was rebelling against my mom and stuff like that, was a man named Bob Epstein. Bob Epstein was the curator, one of the curators, well, he was the original curator, and then basically spearheaded the film preservation movement almost single-handedly. At least he got it started, and then a group of people formed around him at UCLA, at the UCLA Film Archives. And he saved countless reels of priceless film from being dumped in the ocean, because that's what the studios were doing when they had these vaults that they were renting for years and years and years, and film was disintegrating in them. When I met Bob at FilmX, the Los Angeles International Film Exposition, wandering around behind the curtain, as it were, there, I met Bob, and Bob had a family in Hollywood, a couple of kids, and he took me under his wing, and he exposed me to some of the old Hollywood classics and Frank Capra films and things like that to sort of give me some perspective. So Bob Epstein is my hero. I didn't have a father, and Bob was a kind of a surrogate dad, kind of a reluctant surrogate dad for me, and he had a lot of he gave me a sense that I was going to be okay, you know, and that was very important. And I think young people who are in business right now, who don't know which end is up, someone needs to reach out to them. And I know that Paul Peterson, who has a minor consideration, that organization, aminorcon.org, is an advocate for child actors. And he's a person who is available to other people, young people in the business who might be going through something like that. But, you know, he's tried to reach out to many people, and, you know, you can only reach to somebody who's reaching back out at you and extending an arm in your direction. So it has to be a two-way street. I reached out to Bob. Bob saw the need that I had and to be mentored, and he mentored me in his own way. And I'm very grateful to him. So of all the people, that would be the only person. I mean, because, you know, on movie sets and TV shows, you work and you develop this family, these people around you who you really get close with, and then when the shooting stops, guess what? Those people go on to their next jobs, and you don't have the relationship with them that you thought you did. That only existed during the whole wonderful production experience, which is what makes it so seductive, which is what makes it such an interesting industry. You know, the only other industry I can think of like that is like, and I'm sorry, I'm rushing here because I know we have a little time. You know, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, there's a group of incredibly intelligent people all focused on doing one thing, and they can put a craft on another planet. And when you're working with a group of people who are all very qualified in their field to make a film, it's an amazing experience. You create this illusion of a story and a reality out of nothing, you know, and it takes a lot of talented people to do that. It's an amazing industry, and it's so sad that it's so full of dumbass people. Sorry.
No, that's perfectly fine. I use far worse terms frequently. Well, Rodimus, I want to thank you so much for your time. Our time is up.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's been fascinating, and this is Jeanette Lefebvre saying goodnight from the People Speak Radio on bbsradio.com.
Thanks for all the great questions.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana, and it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to VBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of us as summer people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.